The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I think I first met Eliza last spring. I have a wonderful neighbor in Chestnut Hill, Ellen Haas, who is the most infectiously enthusiastic person that I've ever met, right there. And Ellen said, we have this most incredible writer who is our writer in residence at Springside, and you really have to meet her, and went on about the kind of reporting she did, the kind of person she was, that she was a poet, that she was doing this incredible book that had taken her to literally four or five different continents. And so I went to the dinner. Eliza is did not graduate from Springside, but went through fifth grade. And the head of school tells me it was the most important years that she spent in her life. I met Eliza, and I was struck both by her friendliness, but obviously underneath it, a sober seriousness about what she was doing. She told me that she had a book that was coming out in the fall. Many people tell me they have books coming out in the fall, and I nod and say, best of luck, write when you get work. I did not feel that about Eliza. I knew that this book, and I knew a little bit about it, would be something special. And so I eagerly looked forward to it when it came out. The book is called The Tenth Parallel, and The Tenth Parallel is basically the line of latitude 700 miles north of the equator, and it is literally the convergence point between the faith of Islam and the faith of Christianity. And Eliza spent 7 years traveling between the Tenth Parallel and the equator, starting in Nigeria and going all the way to the Philippines through the Sudan and Somalia and Indonesia. As the New York Times Book Review said in a glowing front page review, it is a truly, truly remarkable book. And I actually can affirm that because I have read it. It is a book about religion. It is a book about the way two faiths, the faith of Islam and Christianity, these two faiths can believe in one God and disagree on who that one God should be. It is a book about bloodshed, unconscionable, endless bloodshed and hatred. It is a book about hope in the face of doom, and it is a book about doom in the face of hope. It is a book about territorial rights and water rights and arable land rights for farming between these two faiths as they struggle to survive in some of the most difficult geographic conditions in the world. It is a book about the pernicious effect of colonialism, particularly British colonialism, that reverberates to this day. And it is a book of poignant and arching sadness, at least to me, the bitter and endless blood that humankind spills in the name of really what should be the wonder of universal faith. But best of all, perhaps, it is the kind of book that is so sadly becoming an anachronism in the age of strange entertainment that we live in, the bouncing ball from one silly non-scandal to another. Eliza Griswold offers no easy answers in The Tenth Parallel, because there are no easy answers to anything in life, even who should start a quarterback for the Eagles. But she offers the beauty of being a wonderful listener, perhaps the most essential element for a reporter, and she is a great reporter, with work done at The Atlantic and The New Yorker, and was a Nieman Fellow at Harvard. She offers the beauty of treating people, whatever their faith, whatever their beliefs, with respect. She offers the beauty of scholarship and the beauty of writing that is both erudite and elegant and poetic. And she offers the fearlessness that all reporters must have to do something truly great and lasting. I don't know Eliza very well, but I am quite proud of her and quite honored, frankly, to be in the same fraternity of journalists that she is. So, ladies and gentlemen, it is my true honor and pleasure to introduce Eliza Griswold tonight. Thank you.
Hello. First, I'd just like to say thank you so much to the library for having me here this evening. It is a great, great honor. And I just began the touring for this book last night, so to be here at this point feels auspicious. And I'd also like to say thank you to my sister for making the trip down from New York with her babies, and to my parents for being who they are, and just so wonderful, and also to Buzz for that unnecessarily generous introduction. So, anyway, so this book is the culmination of 7 years of traveling in Africa and Asia along a particular fault line where, for reasons of wind and centuries of human migration and other weather, Christianity and Islam largely meet. And that's the 10th parallel. That's the line of latitude 700 miles north of the equator. So since the days at Springside School, have used in my head, lat is flat. I'm sure somebody put that in my head. So when we begin, so we think of the equator, right? So that's horizontal. The 10th parallel is kind of, I'm going to drop that a little bit. So it's kind of here. We think of the 10th parallel running through, and the countries that I traveled in, so from west to east, Nigeria, Sudan, Somalia and Ethiopia, Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines. So what I would do is travel for a while in one of these countries and then come home and think, my gosh, I know nothing. Or could it possibly be what that Nigerian, you know, 80-year-old Nigerian told me about the history of this particular church arriving here and the missionary who brought it? Could that possibly be true? And so I would go home and I would do archival research at different places where I was, were different people who were footing the bill for this lengthy journey. I don't think anyone's in the room who technically did, besides my parents. Anyway, a lot of people have provided me a lot of shelter over the years, and I'm very, very grateful. So that's geographically the space that the book covers. And to give the arc in time a little bit. I began doing this reporting in 2003 when I went to Sudan with Franklin Graham. And Franklin Graham is Billy Graham's son. He is an extremely influential evangelical leader in the United States. At the time, he was the personal pastor to George W. Bush. And Franklin Graham is very different than his father. Both his politics and his belief in supporting those politics and sort of the intertwined reality of faith and foreign policy are pretty pronounced for Franklin. And so in 2003, he was going for the first time ever to meet with a man he considered the devil, a man he had called more evil than Saddam Hussein. And that man is still the president of Sudan today, and his name is Bashir, President Bashir. Right now, Bashir stands indicted for crimes against humanity. He is the architect of the modern world's most violent jihad against Christians and Muslims alike in his own country. He is also the architect who stands behind Darfur. So Graham was going to meet with this man. Why? He was going to meet with him for many reasons. Ideally, to get him to cease and desist from his policies of abusing his own people. But the issue on the table was for Franklin to have the right to proselytize, to preach to Muslims in northern Sudan. That is legal. I mean, it's pretty... what it can do if he were caught doing it, and for whoever he was preaching to, that person could be killed, probably by the person's family member as opposed to the government. So it's a tricky line of legality there. It is technically illegal, but people do try to do this kind of work. So Graham wanted the right to do it openly. And so he was using this moment in history to go meet with this very bad man. The other reason that Bashir was so eager to have this meeting was that he was terrified that Sudan, after Iraq and Afghanistan, would become the third rogue Muslim regime that the Bush administration would take down. And so it seemed like a very good idea at that time in history to invite powerful evangelical leaders from the U.S. to come and see how friendly Sudan was. The reason we are most familiar with Franklin Graham's name is he very famously called Islam a wicked and evil religion days after September 11th. So that kind of put him on the international charts, and it very much alarmed the Sudanese people, because here he was a guest of the state, a guest of an Islamic state, having made those comments. So I went along. I wanted to see how faith and foreign policy, how do those two issues really come to bear? What really, you know, we think of this in terms of the Bush White House. This is a pattern that's been going on since before World War II, and it goes on today. So how do religious leaders hold political sway in much of the world, and how do they come to represent the United States? I was really curious about this. So we went in to meet with Bashir. What happened very quickly was that Franklin Graham and Bashir got in a sort of one-upsmanship about converting each other to their respective religions. And actually, what Bashir did say, he spoke only in Arabic. It was quite clear that he understood English, because he didn't wait for what Graham was saying to him to be translated, but he would turn to his translator and say what he was going to say in Arabic. And then the translator would repeat it in English. So at one point, Franklin Graham was talking about a hospital that he has. His organization, Samaritan's Purse, actually has the largest hospital in southern Sudan, in a place called Louis. It has twice been bombed by the government of Sudan, by this man he was sitting with on these two couches. And Graham began to talk about his work with the hospital, and Bashir interrupted in English and turned to his aide and said, "Isn't that the hospital we bombed?" And Graham sat forward and said, "Twice." So then the rest of us were ushered out into a very hot driveway, sweating for hours while these two men had their private meeting. And what Graham told me later is that he had forgotten, but in his blazer pocket, he was carrying a George W. Bush 2004 reelection pin. And he reached into his pocket, discovered the pin, and presented it to Bashir and said, "Mr. President, I understand you're going to be talking to my president later on the phone today. Why don't you tell him you're his first voter here in the Sudan?" So what did he mean by that? He meant he had taken the pin from the desk of Karl Rove's secretary. He meant, watch out, Bashir. I have powerful connections here. And Bashir's response was, you know, a lot of smiling, a lot of "don't bomb us, please." And really, that was pretty illuminating to me. I only found out about this because Graham did not offer this information to me until actually a militant Islamic leader, a man named Hassan al-Tarabi, who's called the Pope of Terrorism. He hosted bin Laden for years during the 90s, and Carlos the Jackal and many other savory characters. So this militant leader, when I went to meet him to show how much he had sort of an ear inside the presidential palace, said, "Oh yeah, did Graham tell you about the pin?" So then I went scrambling back to Graham and said, "Excuse me, did this happen?" So that's how that story came to light. So I tell that story in the book, and then I was there actually doing a magazine story. It was one of my first magazine stories, and in our business, it's called Getting Killed. It got killed. It never ran, and it was for Vanity Fair, and they sent me off to do this. And in the course of, so I'm doing the reporting, we get back from the palace, and there is a prayer meeting. And during the prayer meeting, we were standing around. Franklin Graham was leading a meeting of different Sudanese Christians, and we were standing in a circle, and he asked us to pray, and I lowered my head without thinking about it, but that's what I would do in a gesture of prayer and respect. And afterwards, his number two, who is one of the toughest people I've ever met in my life, a man named Ken Isaacs, came up to me, and I thought I would read a little bit this evening from that encounter. Partly because the word Philadelphia is in it, but that's... Okay. So this is just after this moment of praying. In the hallway a few minutes later, Ken Isaacs, Graham's second in command, a tall, hard-jawed North Carolinian who would go on to head the Office of U.S. Foreign Disaster Assistance under President Bush, approached me and asked, "What's your background?" "Originally, I came from Philadelphia," I told him. "That's not what I meant," he said. "Was I a believer or not? Salvation was absolute, saved or damned. There was no in-between. Which was I?" To me, the question required a more complex answer. I was raised as the daughter of an Episcopal priest, and I grew up in a rectory in suburban Philadelphia during the 70s and 80s, a particularly progressive moment for the church. Worship included Passover Seders, Jesus Christ Superstar, and doing the crop hunger walk, as well as gathering around an altar and eating homemade organic wheat bread as the Eucharist. This was the bustling, clamorous world of public religion. Talking and listening to God involved a quiet conversation, and words, I was sure, were the way to reach his ear. For me, as a six-year-old girl, going out to play often meant sneaking next door to the dark, cool church. I learned to read by standing at the pulpit and practicing the Bible's cadences out over the empty pews. I saw the Bible sitting open on the brass lectern, a red satin ribbon marking the page, as a book of spells, one whose extravagant metaphors, whose terrible and powerful parables were ways to call God down to earth. In college 15 years later, I read the work of the 20th century Romanian historian and theologian Mircea Eliade, when I came across his concept of hierophany, the spaces where the sacred and secular worlds meet and people's attempt to create them through ceremony, I understood what I had been up to as a child. At Sunday school, a boy my age, Tyson Smith, but that's not in the book. At Sunday school, a boy my age once asked me if my father was God. "No, he's God's best friend," I replied. I saw my loving, distant, distractible father caught between two worlds. One was a place of worldly decisions and unexpected phone calls. Once I watched him rip the rectory's black rotary phone right off the wall. The other was a sacred realm in which he was a servant, not a leader. When I was 12, he was elected the Episcopal Bishop of Chicago, and so we moved from a Philadelphia suburb to the urban shore of Lake Michigan. At his consecration, the rite in which a person formally offers himself to God as a bishop, my father, following long tradition, lay face down on the cathedral floor with his legs extended and arms outstretched, his body forming the shape of a cross. There was something about this act of utter surrender that terrified and angered me. What right had God and the several thousand Midwestern strangers in the pews to demand my father's life? "When are they going to let Dad up?" I asked my mother. Although I feared for my father, I also feared for myself. What did God want from us anyway? As a teenager, I grew petrified of God's will. What if he were to swoop down and ask me to submit also? What could faith cost me? It could cost me myself, I concluded. Frankly, I was afraid God would ask me to be a nun. My father's uncompromising commitment to the articles of his faith proved difficult for me to reconcile with his progressive values and his critical intelligence. I spent those years wondering how it was that smart people could believe in God. Okay, so then what happens is Ken Isaacs, the second in command, tells me that I need to tell Franklin Graham who my father is. Okay? And so what happens, I'm just going to keep reading because I think that's going to be a little bit clearer. Okay. You have 30 seconds to tell Franklin, Isaac said. Graham was in the dining room eating a lunch of oxtail soup with 12 members of his entourage. In the doorway, I hesitated. 13 seconds, Isaac said, standing behind me. I sat down at the table and told Graham who my father was. Graham listened, then looked at me and flashed a smile. Not the familiar high-watt public beam, but a private and mischievous grin. He and I were kin. For although we were raised with very different understandings of what it meant to be a Christian, we were also fellow PKs, or preacher's kids, mottled sheep who had grown up caught between religious parents and private rebellion. But that's where our similarity ended. As far as he was concerned, the fact that I had not accepted Jesus Christ as my personal Lord and Savior meant I was going to hell. There is no middle ground. Salvation is black and white, Graham told me. He had made this choice for Christ himself. Why hadn't I? I asked him to clarify. What did he mean by praying to Jesus? How was that different from praying to God? The clatter of soup spoons ceased. Graham looked at me and said, Jesus is the only one who died for our sins. Muhammad didn't do that. Buddha died still searching for truth. He quoted what I later learned was the gospel according to John 14, verse 6. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. End quote. There was only one way to be saved and to be assured a place in heaven, through faith in Jesus Christ. If your plane crashes tomorrow, he asked, are you absolutely sure you'll go to heaven? I thought for a moment. No. Would you be willing to pray with me now? Okay. If that didn't sell a book. So that is by far the most personal section of the book, because most of it is reported over this 9,000-mile-long journey and territory, and also over the course of nearly 2,000 years. Because as I would go and do the firsthand kind of reporting that we do, land somewhere, find a local journalist who would know about this. That person gives you phone numbers. You know that's how it kind of works. People would drop these pieces of history. And one of the ones that I learned while I was in Sudan on that first trip, and this really formed the spine of the book, was that the British had divided Sudan on the 10th parallel in 1904 because they had faced a horrible rebellion, an Islamic rebellion, in the late 1800s. And what we don't know, because what I certainly didn't know, is that there had been a great many of what we know, we hear the word, there had been a great many jihads in northern Africa during the 19th century. What that means is, I mean, that word could mean a ton of things, and we certainly hear it bandied about a lot in the press. Principally what that meant, most of North Africa is Sufi. So along this line, Muslim North Africa, which is made up of 400 million Muslims, and then Christian, I'm generalizing a little bit, Christian Africa underneath the 10th parallel, which is about 350 million people. That's where this meets. So this is really the southern edge of the Muslim world in Africa. So what had happened is that Sufi leaders, because that's a primarily Sufi group, and Sufis believe that you meet God through the human heart. It's a mystical faith. These guys, a bunch of religious teachers, had tried to purify the faith, basically against corrupt kings. And so they had launched what they called jihads, holy wars, to say, you know what, things that surprise us today, women have to be educated in this town, no more unfair taxes, everybody has to be able to read. So this really helped Islam establish a foothold in the north. One of these leaders ended up opposing the British, and he was called the Mahdi, or the Mahdi, but Mahdi is fine. And he was a bad dude. And this guy enslaved people. He enslaved fellow Muslims. He put nuns and priests into prison. But he found a very convenient war against the British, basically. And he actually defeated the British. And they faced a huge public shame in Africa, in the late 1880s. And they lost a war at the hands of Islam. And this is actually one of the formative historical experiences that shaped colonial policy and some of the West policies toward Islam to this day. So the British lose this war. They wait a couple of years. There's huge public sentiment behind them. What stopped Islam from winning Africa? Get in there, defeat the Mahdi. They go back, and with the help of the Maxim gun, they end up winning Sudan, which they don't particularly want. It's a million square miles, still today, largest country in Africa. And they have to figure out how to govern this area, and they have to figure out how to stop another Islamic rebellion. And they decide that the best way to do that is to stop Christian missionaries from working and trying to do exactly what Graham is doing today, trying to evangelize among Muslims. So they create this line, the 10th parallel, and they say, guess what, you missionaries? You're south of that line. Don't come north of that line. You may not work among Muslims to the north. And they said eventually to Arab traders who would be Muslim, guys, you're not going to the south anymore. So this divide already, because it is where the dry north ends on the 10th parallel and the wet south begins, this had been a place where Islam had had to stop, because where the wetland began, so did the jungle, and where the jungle began, so did tsetse flies. And tsetse flies carried sleeping sickness, and the sleeping sickness effectively killed off camels and horses. So any Arab traders or any Muslims trying to come south of the 10th parallel anyway had had a very hard time of it, and that's certainly partly why the British chose this line. Anyway, the result of this line today is more than 40 years of civil war and the death of at least 2 million people. So, and that is not a simple, that's not one simple causal relationship. That has to do with all kinds of things. The fact that in the South, the British left the missionaries to do any kind of work that needed to be done. And that's what Graham's doing today, because there is no other hospital. There are no other. Now there's schools. But all schools were missionary schools. All hospitals, all clinics, everything was missionary. So when we look at this divide today, we see the legacy, certainly of the British Empire, and of what it has meant to arbitrarily divide a country on these lines. To bring us just up to speed, historically, what is happening now is North and South signed a peace deal in 2005. And I'm going to read a little bit, and I'm going to hope it's clear from what I'm reading. Right on the 10th parallel now, most of the oil in Sudan is underneath the 10th parallel. An estimated 2 billion barrels of light sweet crude are running in a black river underneath the ground, and both North and South want this oil, and everybody's using everything they can to guarantee their right to it. So what you want to do is fight over the land, because if you have the land, you have what's beneath it. And religion is frequently used, especially by the North. As I said earlier, the North declared a jihad against the South and said, guess what, get off our land. Well, did they want the land? Kind of. Did they want the oil? Absolutely. And so North and South are facing a possible return to war because the South is supposed to have the right to vote for its own independence, which it has never had. This is supposed to happen in January, but the North doesn't want to give it to it. We'll see. So I've spent some time along this line in one of the villages that is the absolute – it is the frontline village of where the North ends and the South begins. So I'm just going to read you a tiny bit from that, and we will go with that. Okay, so – the chief was spending Easter Sunday in his hut, which smelled of stale smoke from a cooking fire and of something more glandular, panic. When the visitor from Washington ducked inside, the chief, a man in his mid-50s named Neil Pedwat, rose stiff-kneed from a white plastic lawn chair. He had spent several days keeping watch against an approaching dust cloud kicked up by horsemen and jeeps. It would mean his village of Todaj, teetering on the fraught and murky border between northern and southern Sudan, was under attack again. He was grouchy and unkempt, his eyes pouched, his salt and pepper beard scruffy, his waxy green and yellow shirt stained with the tide lines of dried sweat. He glowered at the American visitor, Roger Winter, whose bare legs poked out from khaki shorts. One leg bore the scar of a snake bite he had gotten not far away while helping to broker a peace on behalf of the United States. The 2005 deal was supposed to end nearly 40 years of intermittent civil war between northern and southern Sudan, which had left 2 million people dead. In some places, the peace agreement had staunched the bloodshed, allowing the South to form a nascent government that described itself as Christian-led. Under the terms of the deal, the North was supposed to make it attractive for the South to remain part of a unified Sudan by giving it a voice in the national government and a fair share of oil revenues. But the North ignored most of the terms. The peace deal proved to mean nothing here on the boundary between the two Sudans, which jigs and jags like an EKG reading along the straight, flat latitude of the 10th parallel. So I will just end by giving a brief sort of overview of what I found in doing this reporting. And the truth is this book does not have, and I think through the wall I heard Buzz alluding to this, this book does not have an overarching driving thesis of this is the clash of civilizations. In fact, quite the opposite. I believe the greatest religious clashes we're overlooking right now are the clashes inside of religions, the clashes between Christians and Christians, Muslims and Muslims over who speaks for God. When we see something happening like we do at Ground Zero or on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, those discussions are, although Islam provides a very convenient enemy, and there's no greater way to whip up fear in followers than a shared enemy, that fight is not really a fight against Islam. That fight is a fight inside the secular or Christian West over who has the right to say who a true Christian is. Is it Franklin Graham? Is that who a true believer is? Is Barack Obama a real Christian? Who is a Christian? What does that mean? Well, we see that closer to home, and we see it explicitly because the book, I'm not talking about Judaism because the book deals explicitly with Christianity and Islam, although the same patterns are true. We see this struggle inside Christianity closer to us, certainly over issues, and the book deals with some of these about homosexuality and cultural issues that, for example, you know, how that works, how does homosexuality become so frightening to African Christians? Well, you know, just a very quick story about driving along in Congo one night, and Congo's not in this book. I was doing another story, and it was late, and there was a very bad war on, and the road we were driving down was only a road because of logging. It was not a road. It was a logger's road. It was a way for them to get wood out and very conveniently for rebels to get in to people who had not been affected by a terrible war so far. The driver and I started to talk about homosexuality, as you do, late at night on a road. And you know, he I really, because of my own sort of liberal context, you know, I really was struggling with how he could believe that this was an evil and a sin. And, you know, he made it pretty clear very quickly that what most people, and not just Muslims, see of the West are missionaries, are soldiers, and Britney Spears. So this secular context, this idea of you're taking our Bible away from us, and what are you leaving behind? This idea that somehow, because that is the common understanding, that homosexuality comes from the West, is a Western import, much like some diseases are. That's just the idea. You came, your cultural imperialism took over, and now we have one thing to defend us, the Bible, and its literal truth. And you will not take that from us. So that conversation was very illuminating to me. And it happened not only, I mean, that's what it looks like in a snapshot in a Christian context. The exact same thing is happening within a Muslim context, this fight over who speaks for God. And it happens between liberals and conservatives, and it happens between Sunnis and Shias, or what we're seeing in Africa, which is upsetting, is this very vibrant Sufi, you know, Sufis, watching them worship looks like a Pentecostal church service. It's drums and singing and dancing, and there are more and more divides with a sort of more hardline Arab sensibility that's saying, you know, you guys are not true believers. So these are really what we need to watch, and we certainly need to communicate more along those lines. You know, I've been facing a lot of questions, as, you know, certainly with the events unfolding about, you know, why do they want us dead? And I think, why do you want them dead? And what do you mean? We don't want them dead. You know, like, well, what do you think they've seen? They've seen a cuckoo on the TV wanting to burn Qurans, and they understand the Christian West to be at war with them. They think you want them dead. So how do we start to change some of these messages? That's really what the book is hopefully really designed to do, and to bring home here some of these voices of what it means to believe in one's core, that one's daily life is patterned by belief in God across a political, social, socioeconomic spectrum. And that, I think, is where I will end tonight. So thank you so much.
The disagreement, or the let's call it a fight, between Christians and Christians is something that we probably know a little bit more about than we'd like to. Could you speak more about the same conflict within Islam?
Sure. It's exactly, I mean, one of the, there are different ways to talk about it. First would be the disagreement between different kinds of people who believe in different tenets of the faith, right? So the one we hear most about, right, because we hear about what's going on between Iran and Iraq would be Sunnis and Shias. So that's one of the main ones. And then we have the divide between what I'm seeing more of is this, because I get excited about the possibility of Sufism, of this really, one word one would use is syncretic, right? Because it incorporates, Sufism is everywhere. It's not just Africa. And Sufis are able to move in a much more, the identity is extremely flexible. But that same flexible identity is being called into question by, and you know, they exist, and so we have to be honest about them. The very hardline Sunni, you know, the convenient word, although we try and grow out of this word, is Wahhabi presence, you know, this petro-Islam that has definitely reached into different areas of the world and made its presence felt. Now, one of the reasons that that's happened is not just that some fat cats somewhere are trying to seize power. It's because Islam, like Christianity, is in the midst of this extremely vibrant, effervescent revival. where it is more important than it has been in, let's say, 100 years. Because if you look 100 years ago, you can see some of these patterns in both Islam and Christianity. It's suddenly extremely important to have a personal relationship with God. And once that happens, I mean, you can look at different ways in which that happens. Globalization. So where Islam used to be mediated very much by religious leaders, imams, like priests, now people have direct access to texts. They have a feeling that they understand these texts, and they don't need religious authority to tell them whether it's legitimate to go fight jihad in Afghanistan or not. So that sort of breakdown of power and that idea that I have God's authority within me because I have this personal relationship with God is visible in both Christianity and Islam, and it can be very dangerous. It's also extremely exciting. So it's not one thing. Okay, so that gets to some of the sort of differences. I'm not going to get into questions of doctrine because it's a lot, but that gives you a sense of who's some different big groups within Islam. When it comes to, like, the way in the Christian, we'll see kind of strange bedfellows between liberal groups within Christianity and conservative groups within Christianity. Same thing in Islam. There is right now a movement we don't hear very much about called Liberal Islam, and one of its leaders, Abdullahi Anaim, is a professor at Emory, who is calling for a reinterpretation of the Quran. This idea that you simply cannot locate social code in the 7th century and leave it at that. So, and although I refer to Professor Anaim because people are somewhat familiar with him, there are millions of people behind him. And, you know, I've seen this in Islam, in the world's largest, you know, okay, so great statistic, there are 1 billion Muslims in the world, 4 out of 5 of them live outside the Arab world. They live in Africa. They live in Asia. The largest Muslim country is Indonesia. It is one of the most vibrant democracies I've ever seen. And you could go, you can watch all of this happen there between this secular, wealthy women's group who's saying, you know, back off and you guys don't control social code, to conservatives. It's all playing out within a democracy. So when people ask me, is Islam compatible with democracy? The short answer to that is it's happening right now in Indonesia. Is it compatible? Who knows? It exists. And so part of the book's job is to take that lens of where Islam, look at Islam besides Islam in Iraq. You know, let's see what this religion looks like across cultures and continents. So I hope that was helpful. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I did enjoy your book. I was in the Sudan in the 70s, and so I'm going to do a little pushing. I appreciated what you said in the book about the Sudan, but I think there's not enough critique of the United States. I mean, your book can't do everything, but I'm... an important question is who's making money out of whatever's going on? And our policy in Africa is based in part on oil. Our interest in the Sudan has grown since the oil was discovered. Before then, the war that I knew, the first war, was of not great interest. People could die and nobody cared. I think that it's interesting that Darfur became such a crying call to arms, when I think Americans would have been more properly concerned with what was going on in the Congo. And why was the Darfur campaign so popular? I believe it was because we had a convenient Islamic enemy. He was being a bad man. I mean, I object to that language you were using, but, you know, it's too easy to demonize.
May I ask your question? I'm sorry.
There's so much going on in my mind. My question is, how can you, in your travels, since it's not in your book, bring that to the fore for Americans to think about? Because it's too easy to say it's just Britney Spears and soldiers and I forget the third term you used.
I'm going to complicate that even more, which is, you know, right now the major, so a lot of, it's a great point. Thank you for bringing it up, especially, you know, it's a very thing one wants to say sensitively, but the death rate in Darfur is minimal compared to a death rate in Congo. And yet no one pays attention and the Darfur lobby continues. So I totally agree with you. Not very important point. So a lot of U.S. companies have divested in terms of oil from Sudan because it's really bad PR, and they've started to learn that PR can cost them. Who's there? The Chinese. So in a lot of these towns, I am not kidding. This was shocking to me, and I with my own sort of, you know, finger wagging, I didn't want them to say that. But a lot of the southern Sudanese said to me, bring Chevron back. We don't want these Chinese here. You know, at least you guys spoke to us. At least you spoke. So what's going on now? And China, Malaysia is a huge, has a huge oil interest in Sudan. They get a totally free pass. What these countries do, and this is no great news, but and this is in the book, that they support militarily. They support the northern Sudanese, the government, right? They help them. Either they give them arms or they give them money to buy arms. And then the government helps drive these totally impromptu, basically death squads to get people off what's traditionally been their land so that the foreign companies can have the oil beneath them. I would love for Malaysia to come under more criticism for this because I think China is too easy to attack and frequently attacks on China are just ineffective. But Malaysia needs a lot more scrutiny. So thank you for bringing that up. Any other questions? Yeah.
Yeah. To what extent do you think that the being disenfranchised and poverty plays into this fundamentalism on both sides, the you know, between Christianity and Muslimism?
That's such a good question. And actually, somebody asked me that last night, and you know, what I ultimately found in terms of trying to contextualize what people believed is that it was impossible to do that. I mean, there's no question that people who have so much less, who have nothing, do find, in my experience of seeing it, do find a deeper connection with their understanding of God. Now, so does that lead toward fundamentalism? Tricky to say. We certainly have plenty of examples of the world's worst and most dangerous fundamentalisms who have very deep pockets. So that doesn't always follow. But when I was writing the book, I ultimately found that I couldn't judge why people believed what they did. And I really couldn't assess that because most of the most interesting conversations I had in the course of reporting this would, of course, come when the tables turned in an interview, right? When somebody said, what do you believe? Right? And I would answer that as honestly as I could. I would answer that honestly, which is, you know, I was raised in a Christian household. I don't consider myself a Christian besides in that upbringing. I don't hold Jesus to be any more of a prophet than Muhammad or the Buddha, right? So out of that would come these super interesting conversations. And I always felt that I was playing catch up to somebody else's deeper faith and deeper life context, even when they were so fundamentalist. And even in situations where they had committed violence, there are exceptions. There's a guy in the Indonesian section who's been tortured terribly, terribly. This guy is a member of, he's a member of an Al-Qaeda linked group. He's killed many, many people, both in Afghanistan. He's killed his own people in Indonesia. He helped teach Muslims how to kill Christians on an island. He's one exception to that. He's somebody who I look at and I think your context, he's mostly brain dead. It's hard to know whether he was slow before he lived this life or if it's the result of torture, electroshock primarily. But so It's a good question. I'm sorry to ramble a bit. I don't have an easy answer for you. I wish I had, but people just came across as individuals to me, and I just had to try to communicate that as best I could and leave conclusions to the reader because I couldn't make them. Education certainly plays a role, and certainly, as you're saying, the sense of having other options besides violence. So, yeah.
You said that you also traveled in Ethiopia. We've been to Ethiopia, and in Ethiopia, I think the situation seemed to us to be quite different, namely that Christianity was established there in the 4th century. It's an Orthodox faith. We saw a lot of evidence of religious groups, American religious groups, to do work as NGOs, but not a lot of evidence of proselytizing or new churches being built or anything like that. At the same time, Ethiopia also has Muslims. So what was your impression of Ethiopia in that regard?
So Ethiopia, absolutely true. The reason you didn't see a lot of evidence of churches being built is because the Ethiopian Orthodox Church forbids it, right? So there is definitely one of these super pronounced struggles inside of Christianity. In fact, the hottest struggle I saw in Ethiopia was in a town called Harar, a traditionally Islamic city, where Haile Selassie, the last emperor, had taken over the local mosque and said, this has to be a church now. This church, so it's an Ethiopian Orthodox church, was in a hot fight with the local Pentecostal churches because, like their Muslim neighbors, they had started broadcasting with loudspeakers their own sermons, right? And so they were just shouting into the air, and it was something to watch. Now, one of the most interesting pieces of history that I certainly learned in the course of reporting this book is that actually Muhammad sent, in 615 AD, Muhammad was under war with his own people, the Quraysh. He had to leave his hometown of Mecca. He fled to a nearby town, then called Yathrib, now called Medina, city of the Prophet, 200 miles away. He goes there, and he has to send a dozen of his followers and his own daughter, Rukia, to the safest place he knows. Where does he send them? Ethiopia, to the court of a Christian king, because there was no bond greater than this belief in a shared God. Now, to that point, Somalia is currently embroiled in a war that I have never seen the likes of, worse than Congo, in what I've seen reporting in Eastern Congo over the years. That war was initiated by an Ethiopian invasion in 2006, backed by the United States. A lot of the understanding of that, Meles Zenawi, the president of Ethiopia, it's unclear. Did he use religion? He's a Marxist. He's not out there beating Bibles. Yet the idea of religious Christian identity being under threat, being a Christian island in a Muslim sea, which is a 19th century quote that Ethiopia has used about itself, and I've had foreign ministers use it to me. So on the surface, absolutely. Tight state control looks pretty calm. You want to see how it's playing out with its neighbors? Situation changes. But it's a good question. Yeah. Okay, one more. Yeah.
Could you talk a little more about how things are on the sort of neighborhood-to-neighborhood level, the small scale where there's an intermixing of religious groups? I have often heard it said that while in principle there are these conflicts and mm-hmm. in actual places people are killing each other, mm-hmm. at the same time there's at least a past history, if not a present situation, where people are people, they know and respect one another, even in some cases use one another's houses of worship if it's closer to go to one than the other. Have you seen that kind of thing? Is it romanticized?
Absolutely. It's not romanticized at all. It's very real. This is one of the things I think we can learn from both Africans and Asians who have a 1,500-year history of coexistence and cooperation. How do they do it? There are certainly – thank you for bringing that up, because I think that is actually the norm, that even when there has been conflict, people find a way to live together again. And that probably sharpest places that that's happened, even sharper than Sudan or Nigeria, because this kind of Christian, well, it's split 50-50, Christian-Muslim. It's Africa's most populous country, 140 million people. These guys really hit it head-to-head. But they do, or they are able to come together afterwards. And usually what I've seen, and this is hopeful, is that the thing that makes people able to get along and go forward is when you introduce a third element. Not when you sit and have some kind of mealy-mouthed interfaith dialogue over, oh, you believe that? Oh, I don't. You know, I think those days are behind us. No offense to that. But if you say to a community of Christians and Muslims who've fought, first of all, you bring the women in. Right? These women are less likely to pick up weapons, and they're also way more likely to buy into a solution because they've got kids. And you say, you guys, you're fighting over firewood because you need to light your cook stoves every single day. Well, we have here these low firewood using, I'm thinking of a group called Green Women in Kaduna, Nigeria. We have these cook stoves. They don't use very much fuel, but they are expensive. So why don't you guys figure it out? How are you going to work together? Do you want the stoves? And if you do, just let us know how you're going to work together. It's that kind of cooperation and community building that I have seen as successful. So anyway, with that, thank you.
Thank you to Eliza and to Buzz for the introduction. Please meet us upstairs where there will be a book signing. Give us a few minutes to get up there. Thank you. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.